need to be better at life. And so my official life motto is be better at life. And each year I pick a slogan, you know, that I want to focus on in my effort to be better at life. So I've had like the have a confidence of a mediocre white man year. I've had the It's probably really hard if you're someone that I love or care about, because I'm trying to keep everybody alive as long as possible.
Yeah, you go hard on me, so I can't imagine what you going with your people, with your family members. You be like, yo, what the fuck are you eating? Right. What's going on, world? Welcome to Read the Fine Print, the show, another episode. I know I didn't give y'all an episode last week, and I really don't have an excuse. I just didn't feel like editing, so you didn't get an episode. It is what it is. I have at least, well, I have three episodes in the can. I have like three recordings scheduled. So, you know, this thing takes time and energy and work. I mean, I'm enjoying it, but it's, you know, sometimes I get tired because I'm a one-man show at this point. But anyway, enough about me. Thank you for tuning in to another episode. This episode is with Candace Gibson. She's an attorney, an Iron Man, a friend, classmate, just an overall good person. She's on the board of a charter school. She's a great lawyer. All these things. And I know, like, I always tell my guests that I introduce them after I do the episode. So I try to coordinate what they say and what the episode is about into the intro. But there's just so many things to say about her. So I'm just going to say she's a wonderful human being and you should follow her. She's very inspirational with her post, and she's very passionate about fitness, the law. She's very passionate about what you're putting in your mouth. Pause. Let me stop being childish. She's very passionate about being your diet and you know, overall health and fitness. So sit back, listen to the episode. And I hope you enjoy it. And as always, if you like it, please like, rate, review, share. And if you find it in your heart, please make a donation. Or if you want to become a sponsor or an advertiser, please hit me up so we could talk. My numbers is getting up. The price is about to go up soon. All right, peace. State your name for the record.
My name is Candace Gibson. I am a lawyer by day and by early morning and evenings, a NASM certified personal trainer. And when I'm not practicing law or training people, I do long course triathlons.
What's going on, Candace? How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Thanks for doing the podcast again. We've been trying to do this thing for months, it feels like. Definitely been months. I ain't gonna say years, but it's been months because I haven't been doing it for years.
It's definitely been months.
Finally got you on the podcast.
You had all of these awesome people before me, so you know you had to work your way through the A-list.
Now, you were one of the first people I asked to do it. The first person I think I asked to do this was actually my cousin. We actually recorded the first one, and you were like the second or third person to ask. That I asked to do it, and I'm on. I guess I got 30 in the can. So this is how long you've been dodging me. Yeah, so okay. I released 27, but I got like three more that's in the can. So,
all right, yeah, I will. So it's a funny side story. I have a really good friend who does Cuban style salsa dancing, and he invited me to a class sometime circa like 2006, 2007, and I'm not going to say that I was busy for a decade, but I didn't go to my first class until like 2016. I was like, I'm a terrible friend, but I loved it. And I like started doing it regularly. I joined a performance group And I was like, yeah. Man, I just been missing out on this for a whole decade because I'm a bad person. I'm going to own that. That's probably my fault that it's taken 30 podcasts to get to me.
Yeah, it's about 30, 31. You about probably 32 that I'm recording. Like I said, at this point, there's only 27 released. But yeah, you have been, I guess the young folks say you have been ghosting me.
Like you ghosted me on The Sopranos.
Yeah, we can talk about that. We can talk about that. I didn't know he was going in hot already.
Right. I didn't know you were like, oh, let's talk about this. And then I watched the series and you're on like season two.
Yeah. So let me give you your flowers. Wow, you can smell them. You are one of the few people. Well, you're one of my favorite people on the internet, on Facebook at least, because I don't know what else. I don't follow you on anything else, I don't think. Do you have any other social media?
I'm on Instagram. I post more on Instagram than anywhere else.
I gotta follow you on Instagram because I never see you on my news feed.
I'm pureperformance.fit.
Okay. All right, and we'll put that in the show notes so people can follow you too. But you're one of my favorite people on the internet. You're one of my favorite people from law school. You were always funny, hilarious. Although we were in different sections, but I can't hold that against you because we had no control over that.
Right.
But I remember you from like, I think the first class that we ever had that we actually talked was, I think it was Trial Lad. And we had the black lawyer, the black judge, and he always be like, preparation. You got to have preparation.
I love that. So, like, I've been thinking about those guys a lot lately, doing some depositions, just being like, did you lawyers never take trial ad? Yeah. Like, Professor Dugas and Judge Burnett and Professor
Eckbo. I think they both passed away, right?
Mm-hmm.
They both passed away. Yeah, I still have my my big books from both, because I took them twice, for the criminal and the civil. I still have, and I used it for the civil. I did use it. But then, yeah, it was one of those things where I don't know what's going on in other law schools, but I feel like, yeah, we were prepared for this real life lawyering, I feel like.
Yes. There are many days when I'm like, thank you, Howard Law, because I can ask a question.
Yeah, definitely. So what's going on? Give the people some background information. Where you from? I see you got the baby hairs popping. Well, not really. You got the waves, so I know you got some Indian in your family or something.
Oh, God.
You got your ancestry DNA yet?
Listen, I haven't. You know, I've been asked about that several times, and I'm just like, one, I don't really I know, like, this seems very, I'm all about intellectual curiosity, but I just don't want to know. I do not want to, like, I know who my white people are. I know who my black people are. I don't need more ancestry than that. And I don't want to, look, you know, my family's got some messy histories. And I already know of, you know, certain people to, right father isn't on the birth certificate. You know, I can relate a little bit to Sean King on that. Not personally, but I know of it. So I'm not trying to open that can of worms. So
gotcha.
No, no Native American that I know about.
Okay.
But I got some white people.
Okay.
So I'm from upstate New York, for real upstate, not Westchester. Like 20 minutes outside of Syracuse. Born and raised, my family is still up there. Upstate New York is fun because we have the flat A, so we don't have the fun New York City accent, but we say things like eggs and legs and elementary instead of elementary. So that's our claim to fame on dialect. I went to undergrad at Cornell University and then law school at Howard, where I met you. And I have been practicing law for over a decade. I do a very niche area of intellectual property law related to imports. And when I'm not doing that, for the last 6 years, I have been a certified personal trainer with my own fitness company.
Cool. Talk about Cornell. You are the first. Are you the first? You're the first Ivy League person, right? Cornell's Ivy League, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Cornell's Ivy League. You're the first Ivy League person I think I had on a podcast.
Okay.
Yeah, talk about Cornell. Does Cornell have a high suicide rate, or is that Brown?
Okay, so here's my take on the suicide rate. The suicide rate at the Ivies rotates each year. Cornell, some years it's Columbia. It just when I started at Cornell, I think NYU was having a problem with people jumping off of roofs. Cornell it's so sensational because they have gorges, right? So you have all these waterfalls, you have these bridges, and you know, people jump off bridges. Mm-hmm. And so it's just sensational and extra dramatic, you know, and not to minimize the loss of life, but I think that there's an aspect of that that just makes it so much worse than other ways of committing suicide. That being said, you know, it's a lovely campus. I don't know how we transition from suicide, but I had a good time at Cornell. I had a really good experience. You know, I know we have a lot of HBCU, PWI, you know, back and forths. I had a great time at Cornell. I had a great time at Howard. There are pros and cons to both. I had a great community at Cornell. Some, you know, my best friends are from Cornell graduates. So, you know, do they need more Black people? Yes. It's like, I think 4 or 5% of the total student body when I was there. And I don't think that those numbers have changed since I've been gone. But you know, it was a good experience.
Got you. Yeah. I try not to get into I don't get involved in those PWI versus HBCU because, I feel sorry for people that didn't have a good time in college, man. I enjoyed, I went to trade school, PWI. It wasn't an Ivy League, but you know, it's one of the top public institutions in the country. I did all right for myself. And I went to HBCU and I had fun and enjoyed and have made great connections with and at each stop. So I see it sometimes scrolling and I've been controlling my input. So I try not to be on Facebook as often as I used to be, but I see it and I get drawn in and I'm like, this is crazy. Like, I feel sorry for you if you didn't have fun in college or you felt like you were like the nigger. I'm like, man, that's a tough 4 years, but I didn't have that experience at all. So
I grew up in a majority white town. I mean, I think we had, so it's a little skewed because I had like 250 people in my graduating class, which people think is a lot, but we had one high school in my hometown. So, so that was it. So we had 250 people in my graduating class. And I think 8 of us were Black. Okay. And so when I got to college, I was so excited to see Black people. I majored in government Africana studies. And I remember maybe my first Christmas, I had been taking some Africana studies course. And I remember talking to my uncle and he's like, what classes are you taking? And I kind of went down the list and he's like, oh, you're taking Africana? So you good at militant right now, right? And I was like, yes, yes, I am. Let's talk about it.
That's funny.
So I was ready to go after that. But, you know, I like Cornell. I like their alum structure. Just a funny side note about Cornell and their alum structure that I think, you know, I give money to Cornell and I give money to Howard. Mm-hmm. And I've given money to both institutions since graduation. Like I have just a recurring payment set up each month. And when I was at Howard, I think I'm maybe like 2-3 years out of undergrad and some dean hit me up and was like, yo, I just want a meeting with you to talk about your alum activities. And I was like, all right. So I have this meeting with this dean and he's like, we just want to thank you for giving to the university. I'm giving Cornell like $20 a year. Uh-huh. Seriously, $20 a year. I've been out for 3 years. And I'm like, do you know how much money I give y'all? And he says, look, and here's the thing, and this is what I think that we as Black people don't always take into consideration. You know, there's a routine to giving, mm-hmm. right? It's not about amounts. It's about the fact that you know, it's like tithing at church, right? Like you just set it up to you. This is what you do every month. This is what you do every year or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so alum who give within the first 5 years of graduation are more likely to give for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think sometimes we as Black people think that we need to be Diddy or Oprah and give mm-hmm. like $20 million all at once, when really you could just be given $20 every other month.
Every other year. Yep. Yeah. Every other month, or however you want to set it up. Yeah. Sure. I had that speech at, I got the speech at Howard too. But I got the speech at Rutgers, and it was saying like, I don't know where I got the speech from, but they were saying like, you basically like become a lifetime member right now. Although it's quote unquote expensive for a student, like you're just graduating, you won't have any money, but they basically gave like that same speech that you just gave. So, and this was at Rutgers. I didn't get that type of speech at Howard, but I got the like, you should need to give. And so I joined the lifetime membership, whatever the fee. It wasn't really a lot, but I mean, I guess if you don't have any money, it's a lot. And I've been given, I can't say I give every year like you, but I definitely give. I've been giving every year consistently since for the last 5 years at least. And like, I give so much. I ain't gonna say so much because it's not a lot of money at all. But they've been getting on my nerves. I'm like, all right, I'm gonna give you your money. So I'm getting all these letters in the mail like, hey, you didn't give your money yet. I'm like, yo, relax, you gonna get your money.
Like, you know that this isn't a bill, right? Like, this is a gift.
Yeah, exactly. I'm getting all these letters from Howard. I get the letters from Howard. I get the letters from Rutgers. And I get the call from Rutgers. And I'm like, and there's always this student on the phone, like working the phones. And I'm like, I give every year, man. Like, I got you. Like, just put it in notes that you don't got to call me.
Right. If somebody else not giving, you could take your efforts and give to them. Like, I'm on a schedule.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. I told the last person I spoke to, I was like, man, just put it in your notes, please, that I'm going to give. Like, I got you. I just haven't given left. Like, you don't have to keep calling me. Like, I'm going to give. Like, I'm one of the people that are going to give.
Right. But I really just want to be able, like, when some stuff goes down, you know, and I have a comment and I want to talk to somebody, I want them to look at my record and be like, this woman has given us money every year for the last decade. Every mm-hmm. year for the last whatever. And so it might not be a strong voice, but I need to have a voice. Like, I need somebody to listen to my complaints.
Yeah. And I also think people like underestimate, because every dollar helps. So it's like, yeah, if you can only give $20, which we all can afford that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, none of us are doing that bad that we can't afford $20, even if it's $20 a year, right? It's right. Not necessarily, like you said, it's not necessarily that you give the big check. But imagine if everyone that was an alum gave $20 a year, which we all can do. Like, that's not, like I said, none of us are struggling. If you're struggling that bad, I'll give you $20 for you.
Right.
reach out to me.
Right. But I also, like, I love that people like Mackenzie Scott are donating to Howard. But I'm also like, you know, we need to be supporting our own institutions as well. Like, we need to be doing, we need to not rely on those types of donations to make large scale improvements and changes to the university. So
absolutely. So how did you get to Cornell? What was your household like?
So you know, I'm gonna say this, and hopefully my mom doesn't watch this. Although I've told her this before. I used to think that I had like this super middle class upbringing, you know, a two parent household. But the older I get, the more I'm like, yo, my family is hood as shit. They just do some stuff where I'm like, oh my God. So I grew up in a two parent household. My parents are, again, hood shit. They're married, but not like together. They just haven't gotten a divorce. And at this point in life, I'm like, you know, I'm a lawyer, right? Like, I could just knock this out for y'all.
Yeah.
And they're just like, no, we're good. I don't understand, but whatever. It works for them.
Mm-hmm.
So neither one of my parents went to college. My dad has a GED. He works at a car dealership. My mom graduated from high school. She works at a factory. Okay. I have an older brother who also didn't go to college. He's a musician. So, you know, fairly working class, like average type, you know, nuclear family. My grandfather, my mother's father, worked at Cornell. And so when I was a kid, you know, he was like, you should go to Cornell. And I was like, okay. I mean, it sounded like a good, you know, the story of my life. My unofficial life motto is it seemed like a good idea at the time. So it seemed like a good idea. And once he said that, I was like, I'm going to go to Cornell. And he said, you should be a lawyer. And I was like, okay. So I said, I'm going to go to Cornell and be a lawyer. So that's what I did.
Gotcha. I'm taking notes. I didn't have my notepad because you hit me with some information that I didn't know. I guess that's why we're doing the podcast. So I did not know. So we had the conversation about the family being hood as shit behind the scenes multiple times. But I did not know that you were the first college grad. We have that in common. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
First college grad, first lawyer. And but it's interesting that I often think of like have you ever read Malcolm Gladwell Outliers?
Yep.
And you know, he talks about like the stuff we can't control and like the only thing we really can control kind of sort of is our time. It's interesting that your grandfather, because your grandfather worked at Cornell and he just put that seed into you, like you should go to Cornell, and that blossomed to who you are today.
Right.
That's interesting. You should write something about that because it's just the proximity of it all, right? And I think that's like the thing that I think is the most important thing about Barack Obama being president. Like, although you may or may not agree with his politics, is that him just being a president, I think, is gonna, like, 20 years from now, like those kids, those black little boys and girls that saw him being president, like they don't even have to imagine like having a black president, because that's all they knew for, like, my son, that's all he knew until
right,
recently.
Right. <You know? laughs> And then I'm sure he was like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, one thing I give my family credit for, so my dad's parents, his dad and his stepmom and his mom, none of them went to college. Like, my dad's grandparents who raised him were sharecroppers, mm-hmm. Which, you know, blows my mind. Like, when I think about it, like, my great grandmother would tell this story that, you know, I asked her once why she married my great grandfather. And she said, we were picking cotton, mm-hmm. and I was slow. And he used to pick extra cotton to give her so she could make her quota. And he was in love with her, and he would ask her to marry him all the time. And she said no. And then one day he said, if you marry me, you don't have to pick cotton anymore. And she was like, okay. And so she might have been like 14. I'm like, what? But this is like, I mean, but this is what makes America crazy, right? Here we are in 2020, you know, and we talk about being so far removed from this history. But even if you're removed from slavery, you're still connected through sharecropping and all the after effects of slavery. And this isn't something that I heard. This is an actual conversation that I had with my great grandmother, where she told this story. And I'm listening to her like, you know, it was 2006, 2007. And I'm having this conversation with this woman about picking cotton. Mm-hmm. Right. That's- so. Yeah,
that's a great story. You need to capture that. See, I'm giving you some content ideas. You definitely need to capture that too. that's a great story. Because like my great grandmother, she actually took care of me a little bit because my mother was a teenage mother, and she did go away to school. She did do 2 years in college, but she didn't finish. So it still makes me the first to finish. But I don't even remember having conversations with her, but I know she definitely like picked cotton and tobacco and all that type of stuff, because I've heard those stories from other people. But just as a sidebar, that's related to like how close we are to like the struggle, although I think we're still in the struggle. But,
right. It's just a morphed and modified struggle. It's the same
thing.
It just presents differently.
Yeah. So my grandmother's brother, great uncle, so he would be a great uncle. He was killed by the KKK. And like my grandmother never ever talked about it ever. Well, not to me. And like that was her, my grandmother was the youngest in her family. So she just passed away this year. But Yeah, she never talked about it, but like that's the effects. Like his kids, his grandkids would be like the equivalent of me, right? It's like like it's a direct. And I don't know if he had any kids. Like my grandmother, I know his wife, or I met his wife before, but they live in the South, so I never had a relationship with them. But like I don't know if his grandkids or anything like that. But it's interesting to be like how close we are to that. Like, cause my grandmother was alive. Like she was just alive to recently. Like, and her brother would have been alive, you know. If I mean, we don't know, but he was killed. Like, we don't know if he would have died of natural causes or not, but he was killed early at an early age. And like, she never talked about it.
And that's
ever.
Trauma, right? So that's when trauma, you look at generational trauma, and at that point, we're not even that far removed from it. And how does losing a brother to white supremacy or violent white supremacy, right? Because a whole lot of us are still dying from white supremacy. It's just more gradual, benign form of it. Mm. You know, that affects people. I mean, I think this came up in The Warmth of Other Suns, Isabel Wilkerson, when she was talking about like the number of Black people who have relatives who left the South and never went back because they were fleeing white mobs, or they were trying to, you know, they had done something to offend someone and they just needed to get out of Dodge. Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that there are Black people right now in New York and Chicago and California who left Georgia and Mississippi and Alabama 40, 50 years ago for some reason like that, and they've just never been back.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's crazy, man. And I mean, these are the conversations. I mean, I don't know what type of butterfly effect like this podcast is having in the world, but I'm trying to do everything that I said I was gonna do, because we don't know when we're punching that clock, and hopefully I'm making some type of change and difference. Like that's been like my motivation really for a long time. Like I haven't really been motivated by money, although I like money. Y'all can send me some money.
it helps a lot.
Yeah, so but hopefully like just sharing these type of stories, I think we're cool, right? Yeah. and from humble beginnings, like just sharing these type of stories will like hit somebody that doesn't know and be like, oh shit, like that's a real thing. Because like these are real stories that we are directly tied to. And it wasn't that long ago. It's not like it's.
Right. But the other part too, and this is one regret that I have. So I just, you know, I was fortunate enough to make it to like my 30s with all my grandparents, and both my grandfathers were remarried. So, and remarried like when my parents were toddlers. Mm-hmm. So I have four grandmothers, and they've been my grandmothers my whole life. So my biological grandmothers, my step-grandmothers, and then my grandfathers. And I just started losing grandparents like 3-4 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then you start thinking afterwards, like, oh, I wish I had asked this question. I wish I had asked this question. And so, you know, to the extent that you have older parents, you know, parents in their 70s and 80s. My parents are young because, you know, teenage parents. Yeah. But my grandparents, you know, I just lost my last great grandparent a year ago.
I saw you share that. Yeah.
And so, you know, to the extent like we could interview our grandparents and our parents to get these stories and, you know, get them on video talking and their mannerisms and sharing that heritage. Like that's one of my bigger regrets, that I didn't record my grandparents talking about stuff, just like what their life was like. Cause then afterwards you're trying to piece it together from, you know, whatever information that you could find. And I love Black people, but we are really quick to call somebody a brother or a sister or a sibling, and they're not. Or a brother, sister, cousin, aunt, something, you know. Uh-huh. I was looking at my grandfather's obituary and I called my cousin and I was like, were they siblings? And she's like, no, they're not. But so-and-so wanted to be listed in the obituary as a sister, even though they're not a sister. And so, so that's my little PSA. Black people, stop doing that. Put the accurate, actual familial relations in the
that, you know, that's not gonna stop anytime soon, because that's like the historic, like, all right, you take care of these kids because I can't take care of them, and then they're raised as brother and sister. So I don't think that's gonna stop anytime soon, but I think we should be accurate, at least in death. Like, let us know like who is who for real,
right? But this stuff starts coming out and it's like, oh
yeah,
nobody wants to deal with that.
Right. Yeah, that's one of my regrets too, is that I try to pass the responsibility off to my aunts and uncles to capture the story while my grandmother was alive. And one aunt was on it. So I have eight, including my mother. My grandmother had eight kids. And I've thought that between eight kids, they they would be able to have those type of interview type questions and capture everything. And to make a long story short, it really didn't happen. So that's one of my regrets too. And I had my grandmother, you know, to until this year. So, and my mother's young. So my mother's only 17 years and some change older than me. So yeah, like she, you know, this is one of those things that we don't have it, but it is, I guess life moves on. So I did take Ancestry though.
Okay. How was that?
Ancestry was super duper. That might be another podcast because I want you. I don't know how long I have you.
I thought about doing Ancestry. You know, my mom is the product of an affair, and so my white grandmother had.
I know what that means? I know what that means. I think my grandmother was too, but go ahead. Yeah.
Right. So my white grandmother had an affair with a black guy while engaged to a white dude. So she gets pregnant and she decides that there's no way possible that this baby can be the black guy's baby because hope springs eternal. And so she goes ahead and she marries this white dude. She has this baby and, you know, the baby's a little creamy color and they're just, why these two English people think they have like a little Italian baby? I don't understand humans, you know, but whatever. And so things were all right for the first like year and a half. And then my grandmother had two more kids and they had like blonde hair and blue eyes. Mm. And, you know, I've seen these pictures of like the three kids, you know, like high school pictures. And so you have my aunt with this long blonde hair and blue eyes and my uncle with this wavy blondish hair and blue eyes and my mom with an afro.
So yeah.
You know, and complexion wise, she could probably pass, but she, you know, her hair, like she could have an actual afro.
Yeah.
And so, you know, she grew up in this small town, like small, like 200 people. Mm-hmm. Like they had a stop sign. And, but they were 30 minutes away from where my grandfather lived, my mom's biological father. Mm-hmm. And she grew up not, I mean, there were no black people in her community. And my grandmother, bless her heart, just was not mentally, emotionally mature enough to kind of handle one being, because then she got divorced, being the mother of these three kids, a single mother of three kids, let alone the single mother of three kids, one of whom was biracial, and she just wasn't equipped to deal with that. So when my mom was eight, she hands her this George Duke album, like, this is what your father looks like. Wow. And so my eight-year-old mother is like, you know, I don't know what this means. And my grandma was prepared to just let my mother go the rest of her life without knowing who her father was. But they had, she and my grandfather had a mutual friend who was dying. And he said, I can't go to the grave knowing that Franklin has a daughter and doesn't know about her. So he reaches out, you know, to my grandmother and tells her this. And my grandmother reaches out to my grandfather and says, okay, by the way, you have a daughter. And my grandfather and his family, bless his heart, you know, it's a few kids that have popped up in that family after years. So it's not unheard of for someone to pop up after X number of years. And so it was just kind of absorbed like nothing, you know. So these are he's my grandfather. It's always been my grandfather. His wife is my grandmother, has always been my grandmother. And there's just, it is what it is. So like, you know, just one thing I love about black people for the most part, like we just accept this stuff, right? So everybody's grandma, everybody's grandpa, everybody is just, you know, acting like this is how it always was. And so when I was growing up, like this was all very normal to me. Much as it's, you know, it's probably normal to a lot of people, just not normal in the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it's crazy. So we gotta talk. I gotta bring you back. So hopefully it's not 15 months to get you back. So talk briefly about your the law you practice. You said a very niche.
Right.
Which one you say, niche or niche?
I mean, I think it's niche.
niche.
But we can call it niche if you want. You
know? I say niche too. I'm fancy a little bit.
All right. So I practice a type of law called 337 litigation and 19 USC section 1337. And it deals with unfair trade practices. So it's a statute that comes out of the Great Depression, and it's designed to, there's some real American stuff here. So it's designed to protect American industries from unfair competition. And so what does unfair competition look like? It looks like patent infringement. It looks like trademark infringement, copyright infringement. But it's not so simple as knockoff goods. So Customs and Border Protection, they have the authority to look at a purse or and say, this purse is a knockoff Louis Vuitton bag, and they can stop it at the border. They have the statutory authority to do that. You can't look at this phone and tell that it infringes a patent. Like, it's just not that obvious. And so Customs doesn't have the authority to render those decisions, so you have to go to court. And so you can go to district court, but let's say you're dealing with infringing products from China, right? Because that's where so many of our infringing products come from. You can't sue a Chinese company in district court.
District court, yeah, absolutely.
Right, because if they don't have assets here, like you sue them, they're not going to show up. You're going to win $1 billion and you're never going to get that money. But really what you want as a remedy is you want to keep their product out of the market. So in our cases, there's in rem jurisdiction. And so it's super fun. So none of the cases are Apple v. Samsung. It's in race certain electric programmable random operating systems and products, you know, contained therein or components thereof, or it's whatever the product is. And so if you default, your product is excluded from the market. If you lose, your product is excluded from the market. And so what does that mean? It means that every time, so Customs and Border Protection gets a piece of paper that says this company, all its subsidiaries, affiliates, assigns, is not allowed to import into the United States these products that infringe. So you're essentially closing off the U.S. market to a certain group of infringing products.
Gotcha. I'm just drinking my water. I'm trying. See, we're going to get into your workout stuff because you be getting on me on everybody. She definitely begin. I'm like, yo, what the hell you eating? Why you eating everything bagels every day?
Well, We're going to get there. So that's the type of law that I practice. It's pretty cool. It can be a little draconian in terms of remedy, but you know, if you're dealing with these technology companies and you're dealing with infringing imports and you can't find who's making the product or how they're getting it into the US, it's a great remedy to protect your market. The catch though is as a plaintiff, you have to show that you have an industry in the United States worthy of being protected. So you have to actually put money into this domestic industry that's not sales. So you have to show that you're manufacturing something here, which almost nobody is. You're doing research and development here. You have some type of plant, labor, equipment, licensing, something in the U.S. that's worthy of protection from these foreign companies. You could show that you have patent infringement. You could show that there's an actual product being imported into the U.S. If you don't show that you have an industry that's worthy of being protected, you lose.
That has to be difficult. I read it was a Noam Chomsky book. I forgot what it was called. But it basically was saying like nothing is made in the U.S. anymore.
There are some things that are made in the U.S., but if you're looking at, I mean, if you look at Apple, for example, Apple has research and development taking place in the United States. They have employees here. They have an industry in the U.S. beyond sales. So it's beyond just manufacturing. Okay. But then there's also, you know, there might be assembly that's happening in the U.S. Like you might get your components from abroad, but you're putting it together here. So there are ways to show that you have an industry here. And again, not everybody is Apple. So if you have a smaller company, you're not, you don't need hundreds. There's no set dollar amount to show for this industry. So you could, you know, in theory, have a couple of $100,000 of investments in the United States that satisfy this requirement.
Got you. Thanks for that clarification. So it's not just manufacturing. It's any viable.
It's research and development, engineering.
I guess that's an easy bar. If you're being smart, that's an easy bar to get over. Or not. Look at your face.
It can be challenging sometimes. It can be challenging, but it's also challenging because there's no bright line rule for, you know, dollar amounts or anything. It's not like, oh, I showed that I had $5 million and therefore I make it, right? Because $5 million might be super significant to one company, but $5 million for Apple might not be significant.
Yeah.
So it really just depends on the type of company that you're looking at and what they're doing.
Got you. All right. We got to talk about that too. I gotta bring you back for that. Cause what I want you to really talk about is what you be getting on me on.
Okay.
Behind fitness. The scenes for years is fitness. So talk about, well, I'm gonna let you drive, but tell us about your company.
Okay.
And tell us about how you got into personal training fitness.
Okay.
Because you weren't like that in law school.
I wasn't that into, I mean, I was, you know, I was trying to be,
I mean,
healthy,
you were fit, you were healthy, but you weren't like
I wasn't personal, doing this.
Yeah, absolutely. So go take us down that road if you.
Okay, so I'll tell you just a little funny side note. So I bought my mom's best friend a Chromebook recently. Like I sent it to her, she got it yesterday, because she sent me a text message. So during the shelter in place, I've been doing family exercise 3 times a week with my mom and my uncle and my aunt. And so my mom's friend hit me up and she's like, oh, I want to do family exercise, but I don't have a Chromebook. So I got to do this and do this. And then when I'm going to save some money, I'm going to get a Chromebook. So I'm like, well, I'm going to just send her a Chromebook. I'm not really sending Chromebooks out like that, but,
yeah,
you know, I'll send her a Chromebook. Right. But I couldn't do a gift receipt and I couldn't like put a little note in there. So she just gets a Chromebook and I forgot to tell her that I sent her a Chromebook. So I get a call yesterday from my mom and she's like, do you need to talk to her about something? And I was like, I don't think so. Did you send her something? I was like, oh, I sent her a Chromebook. Mm-hmm. She gets on the phone. She got this Chromebook in the mail and she knew she didn't order it. She thought someone hacked into her account and ordered a Chromebook from Walmart, and she called Walmart and was like, someone sent me a Chromebook on accident, like how do I get this back to you? So, <Yeah. laughs> but I was telling her that it's probably really hard if you're someone that I love or care about, because I'm trying to keep everybody alive as long as possible.
Yeah, you're hard on me, so I can't imagine what you going with your people, with your family members. So you be like, yo, what the fuck are you eating?
Right. Okay, so I'm gonna tell you, so the biggest push for me in terms of getting healthy, when I was like 27, my grandmother had atherosclerosis. So they, you know, hardening of the arteries, and she had to go and get the plaque scraped out of her arteries. And so I remember being at the hospital, like I drove to New York from, I think I was living in Virginia at the time. And I just remember sitting in the waiting room for her to have this procedure. And it's me, my grandfather, my aunts, and, you know, just sitting there worried, you know, that this person that we love and that we care about is having this surgery. And so when the doctor comes in after the surgery and is talking to us, you know, everyone's all, you know, thank you so much. And me being the lawyer, I'm like, well, what is causing this? What does she need to do in order to keep this from happening again? What, you know, because my grandmother weighed 95 pounds, right? So super slick. So it's like physically looking at her, she's not the type of physical presentation you would expect for high cholesterol or high blood pressure or diabetes or anything like that. But she was a smoker. And so the doctor's like, yeah, she needs to cut back on her cigarettes. But it hit me in that moment that in my family, it doesn't matter if you're overweight or underweight. It matters how you live your life. And so it was just like this real big, like, you need to be focused on healthy living. Like, you need to define what healthy means in terms of watching your salt intake and fat and cholesterol and exercising and not getting into bad habits. Like I don't know how people still pick up smoking at this point in life, but
yeah,
I didn't think I was going to start smoking all of a sudden, but yeah. You know, it's just like making sure that I didn't get any other bad habits. And so that was just that was the turning point from just kind of going through life, doing whatever and thinking about the quality of my food passively to actually saying I need to be concerned with what I put in my body. And at this point, as in now, you know, being a triathlete and biking 100 miles and trying to and requiring my body or asking my body to do all of this physical stuff for me, like I can't put crap into my body and expect to be able to get through, you know, an Ironman triathlon. I can't put crap into my body and expect to get through a 170-mile bike ride. So what I eat and the quality of my food just is extremely important. So that was the click in my brain that said, okay, you really need to be concerned with how you live your life, because it's not a question of being big or little. It's a question of how your health is. And then, so I was, you know, kind of sort of into health and fitness. And I'd been thinking about doing triathlons. And in 2014, I think, I had a really good friend die of breast cancer at 33.
And so I was in the middle. Right?
Hmm?
Shared that on social media, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just remember thinking, one, like, not even health-wise, but I remember thinking, like, am I living the life that I want to live? Like, am I honoring this life that I've been given? And so, kind of funny side note to that, I was in the middle of this trial, and it was my, you know, coming leading up to my birthday, and it was, I don't know, February, and so we had all these snow days. And then, like, 2 weeks before the trial was set to start on my birthday, we won essentially a summary judgment motion. And so the case went away. And so we were prepping for trial in 2 weeks. So we went from having, you know, 14-hour days to nothing. Mm-hmm. And then there were all these snow days. So I'm sitting home and just going through it, right? My friend has died. I'm questioning life. I have all this time on my hands. I'm making vision boards mm-hmm. and 5-year plans. And I was randomly watching, I don't even know what show it was, something on ESPN. And the infamous Skip Bayless, Richard Sherman interview came on. I love this interview so much. When a young Richard Sherman was like, in my 24 years of life, Skip, I'm better at life than you. Which I mean, that's some shit like a 24-year-old would say.
Absolutely. But go ahead. I know exactly what interview you're talking about. I mean, other people might not know.
But I love that interview. But it got me thinking, like, I need to be better at life. And so my official life motto is be better at life. And each year I pick a slogan, you know, that I want to focus on in my effort to be better at life. So I've had like the have a confidence of a mediocre white man year. I've had the ultra candace year. I've had the push it to the limits year. I mean, so each year it's just like, what is my focus for the year? So this year I read Can't Hurt Me by David Goggins.
Yeah, I listened to it. So, you read it or you listened to it?
Oh, I listened to it, which is a whole different experience that you got to listen to it.
That's one of my favorite listens. I don't really like audio books, but that book.
It was good.
Yeah, because it's like a podcast, really.
Right.
Yeah.
Malcolm Gladwell's.
It was crazy. I like David Goggins, but go ahead. My bad.
But on a side note, Malcolm Gladwell's Talking to Strangers.
Talking to Strangers, yeah. I listened to that.
Audio book, yeah.
That's the last one I actually listened to.
Oh, see? Yeah. So, you know, he talks about, you know, most of us are only using like 40% of our actual potential. Mm-hmm. And so this year was like the untapped 60. Like what else, you know, if I'm being slightly confident, I'm pretty sure I'm tapping into more than 40% regularly. Mm-hmm. But for the sake of argument, assuming I was just tapping into 40%, I was like, how do I tap into the untapped 60? And so this year's theme was the untapped 60. But it's just like something where personally, professionally, physically, mentally, like, what am I going to do to take it to the next level? So that started, you know, my friend died and I'm kind of going through this process. And I was just thinking of what are the things that I've wanted to do. And at that point, you know, I'd gotten a divorce, and I was like 4 or 5 years out of my divorce at that point. But I, you know, like started biking a little bit. Mm-hmm. I had started running, dabbling mm-hmm. in running. I wouldn't consider myself a runner. I don't like to run, but I love to bike. And I was kind of doing that. And I said, I'm going to do a triathlon. Like I had been thinking about it for a while. And I was like, I'm going to just sign up. So I signed up for this triathlon training program that a friend of mine from college had recommended, like cold. My coach, he didn't know who I was. He didn't know how I got, like I found him on Google, and then I signed up for a swim class to get me ready. And, you know, it's just off to the races. Like I have a great coach, and I appreciate that he believes in my belief in myself, because I'm like, hey, I know I just signed up with you, but in 355 days, I'm going to do an Ironman. And he was like, okay. But I use that kind of as a springboard to really get serious about, like, to be more structured and serious about my health and my training. And then just, you know, talking about networks, because now I feel like I'm all over the place. You know, when I became a personal trainer, my coach got me my first client.
Okay.
And so, you know, so I trained a lot of triathletes in the beginning of my coaching life, and now I've branched out, and I deal with a lot of people trying to lose weight and people trying to gain strength, but I still dabble in triathlete training as well.
Okay. What's the name of your company?
Pure Performance Fitness. So we're on Instagram, pureperformance.fit. My website is pureperformance.fit.
Okay. I think I was hearing an echo. I guess that could be no echo now. I don't know what that was before. So Pure Performance Fitness. And how has business been in this COVID world?
So I have actually increased clients during COVID.
Okay.
So I have a regular core group of clients. And most of my clients come from word of mouth, because pre-COVID I would go to my clients. So I would like go to their homes and train them in their homes. It removes a step and increases a layer of accountability, like when I knock on your door. So you got to be real gangster to like dodge me when I'm standing outside your house and you know that you're in the house. So I've never had a problem with that. I've never gotten to a house and not had my client be there. But, in these COVID times, you know, it's Zoom, right? Like I'm on Zoom, I'm on Google Meet, like people are there. I have one client who relocated during the pandemic to Memphis, and I still train her. And so it's just a wider range of training availability. So I have more clients now than I think I've ever had.
Oh, wow. Let me hold something then, so I can the hour. She's about to pay my annual.
I'm gonna pay you $20.
So what do you like better? Practicing law or personal training?
I don't think of it as a like better type situation. Personal training is more personally fulfilling. Like to watch. So I have a client who she'll be 79 in November, and I've been training her for the last like 3 years, and she's lost 50 pounds.
Wow. Sheesh.
And
do you go hard on her? Like you go hard on me?
Yes. but I also go hard on her because I'm like, you know, at that point, I'm going to just say this, you're dealing with like older black women, like, ma'am, you are not my Nana. Yeah. And so you got to set the, you know, for people who have certain positions in life, right? Either right. Positions in their family, like you're the matriarch of your family, or you're in a high powered professional position. You know, it can be hard to have someone say, do this, or you're not giving 100%, or you need to up your discipline or your commitment. And there's a little bit of a struggle there. So, you know, we worked through that, and, right, and she's lost her weight, and she had to have a knee replacement. And you know, she had one knee replaced in her 60s, but she recovered better with this knee replacement she just had because she was in better shape. So a moment like that, where you have someone who's in their 70s and they're losing weight and doing stuff that they haven't done in years, or you have, you know, I've had, you know, clients who have lost 20, 30 pounds or are putting on pants that they haven't worn, or gaining the confidence of being able to do things that they haven't done before. Look at, you know, looking in the mirror for the first time in years, just because they had, as they had gained weight, they were avoiding mirrors and were avoiding confronting what they were seeing. So there's a level of personal fulfillment in watching people become stronger, more confident, stronger and more confident about themselves, that you're just not going to get in corporate law. Like, you can have a victory in corporate law. You can be super excited about winning something, but there are no personal, real personal stakes there. Yeah, it doesn't have that same component. That being said, you know, I love the intellectual aspect of the law, which isn't always present in personal training. And I'm able to enjoy personal training because it's not my career. So I enjoy it in a way that I don't know that, I mean, I don't deny that personal trainers as a profession, you know, like they probably love what they do and they get the same type of satisfaction. But for me, because it's not as tied to my livelihood, because I don't need the money in that sense, you know, I can enjoy it a little bit more.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm going to tell you what I like about your style. I don't know what personal trainers do. Like, I mean, I see them here and there, but I never actually had a personal trainer, but I probably should get one now that I'm talking. You might be my personal trainer, but what I like about your style is, like, you got a, like a no nonsense approach. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you change that up depending on who you're talking to. But I like that because I would like to think that I'm a no nonsense guy. Like, I like to, I be saying some wild stuff. I calm down a lot, but I've definitely been known to say like what's on my mind unfiltered, and I've gotten a lot better with that as I've aged, because I've realized like everybody doesn't want to necessarily hear my truth or opinion. So sometimes it's just best to keep it to myself. But I like that style, because that's the, if I was a personal trainer, that's how I would be. And like, I know that that's what I need. Like, yo, son, like, why are you eating the everything bagel with eggs and cheese when I told you not to stop eating that? Well, you're doing it again.
But here's the thing, like we as humans, this is where humans get fascinating. And it's not just in a physical or personal training sense, like it's in so many different ways. Like if you think about all the stuff that we as humans think that we know how to do with literally no training, just because we've done it. So you know, outside of the fitness realm, like humans, we think we're capable of loving, right? Just because why wouldn't we? Like people aren't studying how to love people the right way. But like, what makes you think that you're capable of loving someone like with no study, with no training, you haven't read a book on it. You just think that you have this inherent ability to love properly because you're a human and somebody loved you, even though you don't know if that's the right way to love people, or maybe they didn't love you how you wanted to be loved. We think that we know how to run, right? Because you can just go outside and start running, but we don't necessarily know how to run properly. Mm-hmm. The human body constantly picks the path of least resistance. So your body is gonna have you doing stuff that feels good, even if it's wrong for you. Because your body wants to do whatever is easiest. And so I see people all the time, like who don't know how to squat properly, who don't know how to run properly, but they think they do because they don't need equipment. They don't need to learn how to use something in their minds in order to do it. And that's how you end up getting hurt, right? Because you're doing something and you never thought about, am I running the right way? Am I squatting properly? You're just out there like, well, I can run, so therefore I'm running properly. But food is huge in that regards, right? Do we know how to eat properly? Are we giving thought to what we're eating and why? And like, I have this conversation with my mom all the time. I would put her on blast. Like, I just remember going out to eat with her once and just being like, why are you still eating? Mm-hmm. And she looked at me like, you know, I had asked her some complicated math problem. And she just wasn't, you know, and not in some, oh my God, why are you still eating? But just like, in this moment, why are you still eating? And she's like, well, I don't know. And so we've just been taught, like, we get a plate of food, we have to eat all the food that's on the plate, mm-hmm. right? Because we were taught as children to clear our plates. But at no point during in the process of clearing our plates are we thinking like, am I hungry? Mm-hmm. Am I full? Do I need more food? Am I eating this because it tastes good? Am I eating this because I'm hungry? Am I eating this because I'm bored? And so, you know, there's so much stuff that we do as humans that's just mindless. Mm-hmm. And it's helpful, I think, and I'll say this as a personal trainer, and I have a fitness nutrition specialization and I have a weight loss specialization. So I'm probably like way more aggressive with my questions because I have this background. But, you know, when you ask someone like, why are you eating? Or mm-hmm. I see that you ate 1,000 calories for breakfast, or the last 5 days you've eaten 1,000 calories for breakfast. Like, are you that hungry, or is this mm-hmm. just what you've always done? Mm-hmm. Are those calories better spent spread through other meals? Like, or I noticed that you're eating 50 calories for breakfast and 100 calories for lunch, and you're eating 2,000 calories for dinner. Like, are you starving at that point to the point where you're overeating? Could you spread this food out a little differently? Or so it's, you know, it's asking questions to get people to actually take, to become active participants in their life, in their lives, and what it is that they're doing to their bodies. And I think, you know, we as Americans in particular, like, we just go along with it, right? Like, you know, with my mom and eating all this food on her plate. Eating a plate of food in 1958 or 1960 something when she was a child was a totally different experience from eating a plate of food in 2020. Yeah. But we're not actively participating in being engaged in what we're doing. So we just do it because it's rote and routine. Mm-hmm. We're not thinking about like, oh my goodness, I'm at the Cheesecake Factory and they've really given me a pound and a half of chicken and, you know, 12 ounces of pasta. Should I eat all of this? You know?
You're right. I read something, I think it was in like Men's Health or something about that. And it was talking about like how our plate proportions have changed as Americans, and even just like the makeup of what's in the food that you're actually eating. Mm-hmm. Not only is it like full of like sugar and high fructose corn syrup and all that, but it's also bigger portions than ever. So dealing with the obesity.
And we just eat. And so, like, I always ask my clients, like, the two questions you should be asking yourself every meal, not even every meal, every time you eat, you should be asking yourself, self, why am I eating this? And is it worth it? Because we've all started eating something. And it's just like, I mean, you use the potato salad story, like you go to the cookout and you get some potato salad. I've actually done this. It looked good. I put it on my plate and I took the first bite and I was like, this is terrible. Like, I can't eat this potato salad. And so then you're stuck. Do you eat the potato salad because you don't want to offend somebody? Or do you find a napkin, put the napkin on the potato salad, fold the plate in half and throw it away? Mm-hmm. I'm going to put a napkin on the potato salad, fold the plate in half and throw it away because I'm not wasting calories on some nasty food.
Gotcha. Yeah, I hate potato salad, but so I never had that issue. But that's a great example. But I don't have that trauma and that pain because I don't eat potato salad at all. And people be like, even mother says still to this day, like we like she'll cook something or like when a cookout, so we go to somebody cookout and she be like, you want some potato? I'm like, Ma, you've known me for all these years. You know I don't eat potato salad. Why you keep asking me, do I eat potato salad?
I like how you say all these years and not all of my life, all the years.
Yeah, all the years.
Right.
Yeah, like, you know, but so we coming. I know I don't have you forever, So if you have like, oh, let me give you one. Let me tell you one thing that I was like, all right, I'm convinced. I told you this behind the scenes. So we had our 10 year reunion. I can say anniversary at Howard 2018, right? And like, you know, you see pictures on people online. Everybody got their angles correct, and the secret sauce and the secrets is really the photos that shared. That's when you really see how people really, really look, because that's somebody that shared them. They wasn't focused on their angles and all that. And I was like, I was telling you, like, yo, like, you, I like you doing your thing. We talk, you know, we talk pretty often. We'll communicate pretty often. I like what you're doing. You look good. And then I saw you in person, and we didn't really get to talk like that because I came late and I left early and all for whatever reasons that I'm not going to get into here. But he was like, what's up? We was at the event that was I'm not going to say what I thought about the event on. It was good. Just say it was good on for the, I don't want to offend nobody that set it up. But I was like, yo, you look really, really good. Like, you look better than your pictures. And yeah, I told you that. And I'm like, I rarely see people that look better than they pictures.
Listen, if I have a choice, I prefer to look better in person than I look at my pictures. Yeah, so I'm gonna take that.
Yeah,
you look better. I don't want anyone meeting me like.
Yeah, you look better. I mean, not that you look. I mean, you look wonderful and great in your pictures, but in person, I'm like, damn, Candace look better. Like, cause I rarely ever really meet people that I think look better in person than their pictures. Good, bad. I mean, if you look good on your pictures, obviously you should. Sometimes you do meet people like they look excellent on their pictures, and you see them in person like, damn, like, yo, what's going on? But anyway,
but yeah.
So to close it up, to wrap it up, because I'm gonna try to get you back on. Do you have like any, like, I usually like to give people like some tips and like some homework assignment or like some type of action plans, like 3 tips, mantras, things to think about. That they should do or say or to have a better, healthy lifestyle. You can answer it however you want to answer it.
Okay. So, you know, you and I have talked about this a few times, just in terms of like stretching, yoga, meditation.
Yeah.
I've been doing this family exercise thing, and at the end of every family exercise, we'll stretch for like 5 minutes. And it's like simple stuff like neck rolls and shoulder rolls and, you know, like leaning to the side with your arm over your head. And for my mom, who, you know, is a blue collar worker, she's just like, oh, my goodness, like, this is amazing. And she's at work and she's stretching. She's, you know, trying to get her friends at work to stretch. And I don't think that we often realize that, you know, sitting down all day, like sitting down is, you know, wear and tear on your body. Standing up, working on your feet is wear and tear on your body. And so, like, you need to have a moment of downtime where you're actually like loving on your muscles, right? Or you're resting your brain. And so stretching, I think, becomes so important. And, you know, for all the yoga classes that I do, there's like 5 minutes of meditation at the end.
Okay.
You know, where it's just, I'm stopping, I'm quieting my mind, I'm focused on nothing. And so I think that for us as Black people, especially now, we have a pandemic, we have, I don't even know what's going with what this foolishness is in the White House. There's you know, systemic, there's so many angles coming at us right now. We need self-care. And there are a lot of forms that self-care have taken for us over the years, but there's a lot of stuff that's not available to us right now. And you and I have talked about, you know, grieving during the pandemic and not being around family and friends and not having that person-to-person contact. And so I think it's important for us as a people right now to make sure, you know, there's a little tangent addendum. Therapy, find somebody to talk to if you need to talk to. But then, you know, take a minute away from the news, away from Facebook and social media to stretch and just to love on your body in a gentle way, and to relax your mind. And that's distinct from exercise, right? So there's yoga, there's gentle yoga, meditation, stretching. And then there's actual exercise. Like, are we getting fresh air? Are we moving our body in purposeful ways? Are we making sure that when we're 70, and I do this with my 78-year-old all the time, you know, you reach up to grab something off the refrigerator, you bend over to tie your shoe, you're not going to pull something in your back. Mm-hmm. Like, are you being functional with your movement so that your body is going to be working for you 5, 10, 15 years down the road from now? And that's just real. Like, you know, you look at people, you got a body that's 35 years old. Like, you don't have anything else that you own that is as old as your being. Yeah, right. Yeah. You're looking at your house
like that way, but that's I mean, you only get one body, right?
Right. And so you got people who are like, oh, I need some new shoes. These shoes are too old. Or you got people who are, you know, you got your Jordans, you got your toothbrush and your bleach and you cleaning off your shoes. Are you being that detail oriented about your body? Like, when you think about getting dressed in the clothes that you, what you put on your person, are you giving that much care to the care of that person that you're dressing, right? So don't, you know, lipstick on a pig or, you know, whatever. You still don't want to take off your clothes and not be happy with what's there. So, like, you got to be functional and purposeful about your movement. And then what you put in your body is so crucial. So I'm a huge fan of food tracking because I don't think that we actually know what we're putting in our body over the course of a day. So you start tracking in the morning for breakfast, you track your lunch, you track your dinner, and then you stop at the end and, like, you look at it, right? So for my clients, the first thing that I have them do is I'm just like, just track your food. Don't eat differently. Mm-hmm. Just track what you would normally eat. And so years ago, I had a friend who trying to lose weight and was tracking, was doing Weight Watchers. And he was like, yo, I made it to lunch and I had used all my points for the entire day and half my points for the next day.
Mm-hmm. I've been there just before. Because, right? Weight Watchers, but I've been there.
Right. So, you know, it's just the mindless eating, right? And so if you're not willing to track, because there are people who don't want to track. And I'm like, look, I like tracking. Even if you do keto or paleo or Atkins or whatever, I like to track in the beginning just so you have a sense of what it is that you're doing. But if you don't want to track, you have to cut something out. You have to cut something out. You can do the whole 30. I'm doing whole 30 this month with some of my clients. And it's like no alcohol and no dairy and no whatever. And I'm just like, man. And then because I'm a masochist, I'm doing a juice cleanse on top of that. So I've been like juicing until dinner. And so it's been a process.
You extreme. I'm recognizing this. I knew this about you anyway, but we're getting on the record. Like you go hard. You go hard or go home, which is a great thing.
But I also think that we need to, so this is one reason I like the whole 30, because sometimes we need a reset, right? Like sometimes we don't realize. So I've had to check myself over the years. So I used to put like coconut palm sugar in my coffee. This was my like paleo sugar. Uh-huh. I don't do artificial sweeteners. And, you know, I was like, I paid a mortgage. I can put sugar in my coffee. I mean, this is like this is my reason. I paid a mortgage. I can put sugar in my coffee. I can, you know, I do triathlons. I can put sugar in my coffee. And I was spending like 300 calories a day putting sugar in my coffee. I was just like,
that's a lot.
It was absurd. Yeah. It was absurd. And when I was looking at it on a tracker, I was like, what are you doing? Like, I would ask any client, like, yo, is this worth it? And so I had to learn how to drink coffee without sugar. That was my commitment. Like, I'm gonna drink this coffee, but I got to figure out a way to do it that works better for me. That's not putting something that's good in my body at an extreme amount, right? Because that's the other thing. Like, we need to realize that we can overdo good stuff. So yoga, meditation, stretching, exercise as a distinct category from that, because, right, you need to get your heart rate up, and then what it is that you're putting into your body and being mindful about how you feel about it. So my mom is going to watch this and she's going to be like, I can't stand that you talk about me so much. But so my mom, I had her tracking years ago, and she she was old school, so she would track her food by hand. And she used to work nights. And so she gets home, she had a bad day at work. She gets home, she eats a bag of barbecue potato chips. I don't ask her how big this bag is.
4'2". I've been there before, but go ahead.
So she eats a bag of barbecue potato chips and then she goes to sleep. And she wakes up, you know, later that day, and she's like, I felt terrible. Like, I felt actually terrible. She's like, I went to my little entry in my food journal and put a little sad face next to the barbecue potato chips so I could remember, like, this didn't make me feel good. And so, like, I think that, and this is why I like Whole30, like, because you can cut out processed foods, you can cut out sugars, you can cut out all of this stuff and kind of rebuild from there to figure out how food makes you feel. But that takes me back to what I was saying before. Like, if you don't want to track, you got to cut something out. You got to cut out dairy. You got to cut out bread. You got to cut out fried foods, something that's going to get you in control. Like, I love French fries. I could eat French fries every single day. Give me some Five Guys fries and some ketchup, and I'm just, or some tater tots, like any type of fried potato. I'm here for it. So I don't keep French fries in my house, because if I eat French fries, I also don't keep ice. I'm not ice, big ice cream person, but like chocolate chip cookie dough ice cream. And I'm absurd. Like, I will have a pint of chocolate chip cookie dough ice cream and a tube of cookie dough that I add to, because they never give you enough. And so there's certain things that I don't have in my house, because if I tiptoe into it, I'm going to eat it every single day until it's gone. So, like, you got to know yourself and know what your food triggers are and know what's going to take you over the edge. And then, can you manage it, or do you need to avoid it? So, like, again, this stuff I don't eat in my house, because if it's in my house, I'm not going to manage it properly. So I'm just going to avoid it. Now, I might have some French fries when I go out, but it's just not something that I'm willing to bring into my house and to prepare all the time. So, you know, I think a lot of times we know who we are and we know what we do. We're just not prepared to take the steps to manage that.
Got you. And that could be the mic drop right there, I think. So in summary, I'm just going to get it, people. So Whole30, that's an app, because I think I have that app.
Yeah, right? It's a book. Yeah. It's a website. It's an app. I recommend, if you're struggling with like processed sugars or
I'm gonna do it based off you. I have it on my phone. I had it for years, actually. So
but wait, I want to put this other thing in there too, because the other thing, in addition to processed sugars, because they put sugar in everything, but everything has salt. So when we look at blood pressure for us as Black people, you can't get, you know, we're all about table salt. You can't get high blood pressure from table salt. Like, I need you to understand that you get high blood pressure from processed foods, the breads, the pastas, the jarred pasta sauces, the flavored rice mixes. That's your the soup.
Yeah.
Broth. All of that stuff. That's all outrageous amounts of sodium. Then we want to put all of this processed food in something and then be like, oh, don't sprinkle salt on it, because I'm watching my salt intake. You've got 800% of your daily salt intake from the fact that you're eating some like canned vegetable soup and lunch meat, lunch meat is another, and bacon and turkey bacon and all the different iterations of bacon and sausage and whatever. And then you got the audacity to be like, don't sprinkle salt on my stuff because I'm watching my salt intake.
Yeah.
You're just setting yourself up for failure.
Yeah. That's my Achilles heel is the, you know, this is the, and I mentioned it multiple times, is the bacon, egg and cheese, everything bagel. And yeah, you used to get on top of me like, yo, what are you doing, yo? But let me get the summary in case he haven't been listening. So you actually gave more than three. I think it's more than three. So I'm separating yoga and meditation and stretching, because I think those are all three different things that can be, although yoga is a lot of stretching, but I think it's, I don't want people to think that, you know, you have to do yoga to stretch, right?
Right.
So, and then you got tracking, like tracking what you eat, and I have, know your triggers, like, so don't have certain things in your house. So don't have, if your thing is French fries, don't have French fries in your house. And then the last one, I think it was a major one, and you put it in there at the last second. It was like that salt intake. Oh, you have managing versus avoiding. So can you manage it? If you can't, you should avoid it.
Right.
And then
exercise is distinct from yoga, stretching, meditation.
I didn't have exercise. Yeah, exercise. That was the obvious one, right? And I didn't put it down. So tracking. Okay.
And I feel like you probably have learned this. You can't outwork a bad diet. So
no, you can't.
This is what I tell my clients because they wear me out.
You can't show up
for an hour a week in a training session with me. And this is why I make my clients track. Uh-huh. Because I see them for an hour a week and then they have 100 and however many hours without me.
Without you, yeah.
And I just be on some foolishness. And I'm like, yo. And they're looking at me like, how come I'm not losing weight? And I'm like, because you eating like crazy. Mm-hmm. So just know there's, you know, in my family, people used to say, well, you can eat whatever you want as long as you exercise. No, you can't. No, you can't. That is a lie. That is a lie.
I'm going to tell you what people I do. It's a little secret that I found out helps me. I fast. So I do the 16-8.
Fasting.
Yeah. So it's been helping me. But I also like when I do break the fast, I got to make sure that I have the right stuff around me because I would just eat whatever tastes good, and that's always bad.
That's when the bacon, egg, and cheese, bagels come up.
Yeah, exactly. So I gotta, you know, be mindful of when I break my fast that I have like fresh veggies around or something like that.
But is like preparation, right?
Preparation,
this is basic, you know, proper preparation prevents.
Yeah, preparation. Rest in peace. Rest in peace. Rest in peace to Professor Burnett, the great Judge Burnett. That was his saying. But give people your where they can find you at, everything that you want them to have.
So my Instagram is pureperformance.fit. My website is www.pureperformance.fit, pure, pureperformance.fit.
Okay. And again, if you like this podcast, please subscribe, rate, review, and share. And go follow Candace. And if you ever see him in person, you can be like, damn, he wasn't lying. All right, and I'll catch y'all on the other side.
I mean, there was a pandemic.
That's true. It definitely was a pandemic.
Life was happening. Life was like, I don't care if you're trying to record a podcast or not.